Thanks for tuning in to the Fitness Candor Podcast. I'm Eric Feigl, a personal trainer in Cincinnati, Ohio. I've been training for 10 years and have found that there are many ways to exercise, but one right way, through proper strength training. My hope for this podcast is that you find answers to your fitness questions, learn a little about the history of strength training and fitness, and combine both to maintain a healthy lifestyle. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Fitness Candor Podcast. That's a tongue twister sometimes. I am your host, Eric Feigl, as always, and I'm joined today by someone who I greatly admire and respect and who I honestly can't believe I'm talking to again, which I know he'll make it seem like it's not a big deal, but to me it is. Mr. Gary Bannister, who is the author of one of my favorite books that I have on my nightstand. It's called In Arthur's Shadow, and another book that I also own called If You Like Exercise, Chances Are You're Doing It Wrong. And his third book that I don't yet own, but I guarantee I will, and we'll probably talk a little bit about it, is called Golf Performance Training, What They Won't Tell You. As everybody knows, I'm a strong believer in true principles of strength training, and I think one of the reasons is directly because of Gary. So, Mr. Bannister, thank you so much for being on the show and taking time out of your busy day. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks very much, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor to be here, and again, just as I may have influenced you, I was influenced by Arthur Jones, and that can't be any better than that. So, in terms of high-intensity strength training, it's absolutely so. Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Awesome. And you kind of led us right into it. So is art the reason why you got into strength training, or give us a little bit of background of how you first came to know exercise in general and go from there?
Well, Arthur Jones was not, actually. At the age of 14, I was kind of athletic, and I probably hinted to my dad that I maybe wanted a set of barbells, and I have no idea where that came from. But I just wanted to make myself strong, and golf was my major interest at that time, even though I've been playing hockey since I was 5 years old. But so I got a set of barbells from Sears for Christmas when I was 14, and started lifting weights according to the information that was sent to me, and it wasn't much. Went down the basement and just slugged away at 110-pound set of barbells. That was probably enough at the time, but I later bought a few more plates, and I also, within the first month or two, I ordered from Weider of Canada, which was Ben Weider, Joe Weider's brother, who ran that show. I ordered a set of his strength building courses of the champions kind of thing, and I put up six charts on the wall in the basement, and the basement was pretty crude, and I eventually bought a little bench and got started that way, and I never missed a session. I did it three times a week, and why it was three, I don't know. I think I used to do about three sets of everything, just as they said by the book. And I didn't miss a session for 15 years, not only in my basement, but wherever I was. I got a habit going with that. But at some point, when I got to college, I went to McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. They had nothing for strength training, basically. They had a room that was probably, could pass as a men's bathroom. It was about that big. I hardly had any equipment in it at all. Even though we were a major university of 12,000 students, we had a football team and big hockey program and everything else. No one lifted weights. So they had no facility, basically, other than this, closet strength room. And, the only guys that were in there, I met a sprinter in there. He'd come in about once a month to say hello, and I was in there three times a week. And the exercise physiologist that was my exercise physiologist there, Dr. Digby Sale, who's done quite a bit of research in this field, he was a three-time Canadian champion of the rings, and he was in there. So I struck up a nice relationship with him. He got me interested in the physiology of the whole thing, and during the final year of my graduation, he actually, in a very excitable fashion, which was not his style, he invited me to his office, and he was all pumped up about something, and he had actually received in the mail some information from Nautilus and about what was called then a thinking man's barbell, which was basically the Nautilus pullover machine, and it had a few pictures of Boyer Cole and some of the bodybuilders there, and these promo photos of some beautiful women as well. Anyway, he was so excited about this equipment that it got me kind of going. And actually, about 2 weeks before I graduated, he invited me down to the basement of the school and introduced me to the Nautilus plate-loaded pullover machine, which was unbelievable. And he put me on that thing. Put me on that thing. I had no idea what it was, and I didn't understand that much about it because I didn't have the literature. And it just felt pretty good, and I didn't know much about it. But then I graduated, and went to graduate school in University of North Carolina in Greensboro, and graduated there and got a job at Averett College in Danville, Virginia, 1972. And in 73, there was a Nautilus gym opened up in Danville, and one of the other teachers invited me to go in for a workout. He was a member. And, since I heard the name and heard that it was in town, I just bolted in there. And I was in pretty good shape at the time. I was lifting pretty heavy and going at it. And I got through three exercises, and halfway through the fourth, it was the pullover machine. And I basically had to bail out and go to the bathroom. I vomited for quite a while. It was a leg extension leg press, the compound leg machine. And that blew me out. And then when I hit the floor from that, my legs buckled, which really ticked me off because I was doing some fairly heavy squats. And then I jumped on the leg curl machine more determined and did a set of that. And the fourth exercise was a pullover machine. I did about three or four repetitions of that thing, and I basically got sick, and I could not continue. I couldn't continue, and it blew me out for the rest of the day, and I thought, God, unbelievable. I was a phys ed teacher and in great shape. I was running, 7-10 miles three times a week besides the lifting, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it, and I said, hey, I'm missing something.
How many minutes were you doing those exercises? About five
total, yeah. The guy in there only had about 10 machines, and he was one of these guys who was kind of mixing protein drinks in between my exercise and laughing at me because he knew it was going to happen. That's my introduction to it, and that caught my attention, obviously, and then I started to... He had some literature there, so I purchased the Nautilus Training Principles Bullet Number 1 from him, and Bullet Number 2, and I still have them to this day. And it really changed my thinking about the entire thing, and that's basically how I got hooked up with Arthur. So from
there, and that's an awesome story. And the fact that the person had so many pieces right away is pretty amazing too. So from there on, did you start working with clients and teaching those principles right away, or how long did it take you to realize
the college I was at, Averett College in Danville, had no equipment at all. It was mainly a girls' school before I got there, and they brought me in to start up the men's program, and so I coached basketball and soccer and golf, and women's golf as well, and we were trying to get into the Dixie Conference, which was a big conference in the area, and we eventually did that in 4 years. But we had no facility at all. There was a few barbells I found in a closet again, and I did a little bit of stuff with the basketball team there, but we just didn't have the right setup. So I couldn't figure out anything to do with the Nautilus guy in terms of having the team go over there and stuff. And it was all kind of new. I went to, I met a girl there at school, and she lived in Caracas, Venezuela. And after 4 years at Averett, I went to Caracas as a tourist, and I ended up marrying this girl and got hired by the high school down there. And it was the biggest high school in the city of 5 million people. It was the only American high school. So I taught physical education for 4 years there and saved enough money to basically to buy some Nautilus equipment. It was in the back of my mind that I want to start a gym with this equipment. So I actually started a gym up in Caracas, Venezuela, and ran it for 10 years. And that's basically when I started applying the principles and everything. And I ran it strictly for 10 years. I didn't let anyone come in and just wander around. Everything was controlled and the way it should have been. And because the labor was cheap, I had as many as 10 or 15 instructors on the floor at any one time. So everyone that walked in there got attention. No personal training, but someone would grab you at the door and say, okay, let's go. And we'd try to pound them through a fairly quick, hard workout. And I got, I earned the respect of a lot of people over there and had the Venezuelan Golf Federation, in fact, have me, contacted me to train their male and female teams for the World Team Amateur Championship in 1986. And plus that, I trained a lot of, they had the Pan Am Games there in Caracas, 1983. And my business partner held every record in basketball in that country for years. He was one of my phys ed teachers. One of my peers. So we set up that gym, and we had a lot of success with it and a lot of interest. Unfortunately, the country of Venezuela wasn't the best place to do things. The federations there, all the sports federations were pretty much corrupt, and they had, even though they had the Pan Am Games there and also all sorts of things, it was they had no interest in feeding money into the athletic program at all. So even though we made a feeble attempt to get some of the athletes to train for those events, it was kind of foregone conclusion. But so that's basically it.
I remember reading in, I can't remember which one of the books is. I think it might be in Arthur's Shadow. You mentioned someone walking into that gym and kind of acting like he's Mr. Hot Stuff. And then you're like, okay, well, we'll do a set of pull-ups. And he's like, okay. But then after, the super strict, slow holding the top motion and slow negative motion, he was, wiped out. And I think, that train of thought that anybody can be broken kind of thing is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, this guy came in and he was bragging about how many chin-ups he did every weekend in the park and pull-ups and dips, 300 dips, and this is easy and this is stupid or whatever. So he looked kind of fat and heavy to me, but anyway, he made the mistake of jumping on one of my machines and ripping out a few dips, fast dips, without my permission. And I said, okay, let's see if we can do one chin up. One. So I said, 60 seconds up, 60 seconds down. And this guy said, bullshit. I said, take your jacket off, buddy. You're going to sweat a little bit here. So anyway, at the time, I spoke kind of broken Spanish, so I thought he probably thought the gringo didn't know what he was doing. But anyway, I got him up there, and he probably did about 35 seconds worth in total, and he just landed on the floor, grabbing his arms. He couldn't believe it. I said, well, you can do one or you can do 300, whatever you want to do. And actually, I had no barbells in that gym. I didn't want any barbells in that gym. I had 25 machines, and eventually bought 11 more. But it was just all machines, no barbells. I had a couple of bikes to warm up with, so it was kind of crude. And what we did was the Nautilus system, and that was it, and nothing else. So I didn't care about these bodybuilder guys. I had about 30 of them come in the first year, and I didn't want them to be members anyway, because they'd be more policing than anything else, as you probably have found as well. So.
Oh yeah, it's a different type of breed of person, different style of training. Mm-hmm. You mentioned warm up, which I jotted down some notes because I'm starting to get into doing more research on proper warm up styles. What What are your thoughts on warm-up sets and warm-up exercises? And have you taught that it's not really necessary to do a quote-unquote traditional warm-up set where you might, you know, bang out, whatever, 50% of what you're going to do for 12 to 15 reps? Do you think the muscles are okay under load right away?
Yeah, I think they're under a load right away. I remember Arthur saying you can walk out of a deep freeze and go right to the starting line. And it's certainly in strength training, as long as you do the first three or four repetitions slowly, mm-hmm. that basically is your warm up for the 10 or 12 repetitions you'll eventually get. So right. I don't know that. Besides, let's say you decide to warm up by riding a bike for 5 minutes and then go into the strength training. Well, sure, you got a little circulation going, you feel a little bit looser, all that kind of stuff, and there's some psychological value to that. But let's say you hit a chest press, you have your chest certainly isn't warmed up from riding a bike, and so I think it's overdone in terms of that. And as far as doing a lighter set to start with, I think it's a waste of time.
I think so too. I think the research shows that the first three, well, not the first three, the first rep of every set is going to be, you know, your most dangerous. So keeping it slow and controlled right away is going to be the way to go, right? So first, those first three reps, people who think they can sit down on, you know, said chest press machine and just hammer away at 15, 12 to 15 repetitions or whatever that, you know, the numbers called for, or the load times called for, those first three repetitions should be enough to get to the point where you're 12 to 15 reps and you are smoked. You know, you're done.
Yeah.
And that this kind of brings me back to something you mentioned earlier. You were doing it by the books, you said, when you first started that three sets of exercise. Do you,
yeah.
do you still adhere to that, or do you feel that it's maybe
one
set now?
One set. I don't even do two. Now, granted, most people, including motivated athletes, are probably not capable of going to failure, at least on their own or anywhere, even being pushed. They don't have that concept to start with. So that doesn't justify the fact that we're going to do two sets. I tell them right off the bat, hey, we're doing one set. You got one crack at this thing, dig in. That changes the whole philosophy. If you tell the guy, hey, we're going to do 10 sets of this exercise, then the guy's going to dodge the first nine. You know that. That's human nature. So you just say, hey, we got one chance, and we're not coming back here. So dig in. Give it to me
and
all. So.
And it's not just the positive phase, the negative phase. If not more important, it's just as important. And I really tell people, especially the very beginning of the exercise, you know, hey, focus on that negative repetition. Really feel it going down. Keep a nice, smooth, controlled flow of pattern through the motion. And at the very end, you know, first of all, your positive is going to be your weakest point, especially towards the end of the exercise. That negative
Absolutely.
Is going to get you way more at the very end anyway. So
mm-hmm.
if you can maximize both of them, then, you know, why not?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, as a trainer, you can, if you've got the right equipment and the right spacing and everything else, you can take somebody that's just finishing a set and you know they can't lift it anymore to help them lift a little bit to go through a couple more repetitions by helping them lift and then maybe even pressing against them as they lower because of internal muscle friction. You've got a heck of a lot of braking going on as you're lowering the weight. So. The person will be surprised at how much he can resist your push on a negative repetition there. So,
yeah, all the way through, and yeah, and especially with depending on the equipment, like you said, but that's especially when you hit those legs, you get in those legs, and your trainer calls for two more reps, and you think that's it, it's over. Like, I got nothing left in me. But that just a little bit of assistance, you know, you take just a little bit, if they're assisting that motion going up, it's funny because you've witnessed this, and you got a client who is just, you know, they think they're smoked, like, oh, I can't, this is it, you're doing all the work. But in reality, I mean, their muscles may be feeling like hellfire, but in reality,
yeah,
the trainer is not doing that much work in the assistance part. It's just a couple of pounds, maybe. And it's hard for people to believe. And it's hard to get that across to them, too, that they're still doing most of the work, and they have to push through that. But, but that's...
you'll only get a handful of clients that'll even go that far, I think.
Right.
And if they understand the physiology and the reasons why what you're doing, then it's a little bit more doable. But it's hard to get anyone to that kind of a phase. I don't know whether you read that article about the experiment Arthur did where he actually measured internal muscle friction, and he used Jim Flanagan as his subject. I wrote about that in my first book, I believe, and probably mentioned it in my second. I'm not sure. Where Arthur would say he wanted to find out what happened to the muscle after someone failed. You know, he wanted to take it beyond that to actually see what happened physiologically. And he was still trying to understand why, the reasons why it was possible to lower 40% more weight than you can lift under normal conditions. And so it took him, I think, 17 years, I believe, to find it out. And he found it out finally with his experiment with Jim Flanagan, where Jim was motivated and a reliable subject. So they actually tied him to what was basically an isokinetic machine, a motorized machine, because it was the only thing that could measure some things. And when Jim ran out of steam, they had to have the motor going to lift his leg up and help him. So they set it up and Jim had been on this thing for quite a while, so he was very good at it. And on the screen in front of him was some kind of a chart that he would keep his effort within a certain range or parameter. And in this particular day, I didn't see the experiment, but I heard the video on it, and it was explained to me. They did, I think Jim did 12 or 13 repetitions on his own, keeping his force right in the middle of where he was supposed to there. And then when and I think positive and negative strength dropped off, they measured every repetition, both up and down, it dropped off gradually and fairly quickly as he got into the 10th, 11th, 12th repetition there. And then what they saw was after that, Jim was instructed to push against the pad as hard as he could on the way up, even though the motor was going at a certain slow speed there, and then resist as hard as he could coming down after that. And what they saw on the screen was interesting, and I think Arthur probably suspected, he just couldn't measure it in the past experiments, was that the lifting strength went down the toilet very, very quickly. It just zoomed down to about zero after the 12th, 13th, 14th repetition. And then the negative strength started rising. And that was due to the buildup of internal muscle friction in the last, he went to 25 repetitions, I believe, in total. So they did 12 or 13 repetitions with six guys screaming at him. And Jim said he couldn't walk for, I think it was 2 weeks.
He was a freak, too.
And Jim was a pretty big man, so anyway.
Yeah, he was a freak.
So that was interesting, and of course that excited Arthur because he finally measured what he had thought what his initial thought was on that 17 years ago, so.
That's impressive. If people... You know, I hear a lot when, for some reason, this just brings to mind the leg extension machine and about how so many people are against the leg extension machine, even though it's one of the best machines for quad development. And it, you know, used improperly, any machine or piece of equipment you give somebody is going to be dangerous, you know? But used properly, especially with that negative focus, you can't get injured. You can't get injured doing proper strength training if you know what you're doing and you're doing it correctly. Mm-hmm. And I always give the leg extension as an example because so many people say, well, you know, my physical therapist, even though I know not all physical therapists are equal, my physical therapist says this is one of the worst exercises I could do. And I just try to explain, I just want them to explain to me why. And then, you know, we get into more detail, but I just point to every machine that we were just on and I'll just tell them that used improperly, this used improperly. You know, there's anything, but, you know, obviously Flanagan was able to walk again, so.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing from physical therapists. They're kind of against the leg extension. Of course, they're coming in from a totally different angle than we are, and I don't know, it just doesn't make any sense to me. How can you maximize the strength of your quadriceps if you don't isolate that muscle and use a leg extension machine? I don't think you can. Obviously, there's certain people, certain cases where, hey, you know, every time they get on the thing, it irritates them because they have a certain condition.
Sure.
Maybe
constipation
or something like that. And so it's contrary to the case for some people, but for most people, but like you said, most trainers and, and most therapists are against it. And so it's now an evil machine. And that's the perception of the general public, which is wrong.
I think so too. Well, that brings me to my next question. I know we're wrapping up on time here. We've already covered a lot, but speaking of the general public, who needs, in your opinion, and I think I already know the answer, but who needs, in your opinion, who needs this style of strength training, minus, you know, intensity levels? Who is it for? This is just something I like to hit on because this is kind of the whole point of the podcast, is to get this general consensus across that we all need it and it should be for everyone. In your opinion, who should be using this style of strength training and why?
Well, just like you said, I think everyone should. It's efficient. It's effective. You don't have to live in the gym to get something out of it. The only negative on it, Eric, and it's not a negative other than the perception again, is that it kind of goes against human nature. It's tough when you're burning, like you said, during a leg extension or any exercise, when you think, hey, this is enough, I'm out of here. It's hard to get somebody or get even a self-motivated person to push beyond that and push to a point where they absolutely cannot move it with 100% effort, not an 86% effort. So, in terms of safety and everything else, it's appropriate for anyone at any age. My recent 15 years have probably been training an older population. Some of my clients are in their 80s, upper 80s and 90s. And still, at that point, because there's some medical issues and things going on, some people possibly shouldn't work real hard, and you've got to recognize that. But the same thing applies, is that if you can, and you can motivate anyone, if you can just get one or two more repetitions out of somebody, regardless of their medical condition, I think you're fine. I think you're fine. I think it's pretty safe, and it'll certainly give them better results. With an older crowd, as you know, they probably don't build muscle or as well as a younger crowd, but it's still appropriate. What do people die from nowadays? Lack of mobility. And a lot of that relates to being able to lift themselves out of a chair or lift themselves out of bed or get up and move their body weight around. And if their legs aren't there, heck, a lot of the older people just come in and ride a bike thinking, oh, it's going to make my legs strong and I'll be okay. And they avoid the weights at all, and that's a big mistake. Big mistake.
And what's funny is, you know, it's like to get to the gym, it's going from laying in a bed to sitting at a table eating breakfast to sitting in a chair tying a shoe to sitting in a car, and they go and sit on a bike. And it's that long pattern, and it's partially from what we've been fed, I think, over a few decades now of how important cardiovascular health is, but what I think is missing from that is that people can benefit from, and this is going to lead us down a whole other podcast topic, but the benefits that people can get cardiovascular-wise from strength training. I mean, there are plenty of stats out there that support that, and if you've done it properly, then you definitely know that your cardiovascular is getting worked, especially if you sustain it. And it doesn't take, you know, an hour on the elliptical or a treadmill or a 10-mile run to get you up there. It doesn't take that, and it doesn't need to be like that. You get you in, you get out, and you keep going.
Right. Well, I think, the problem is that the average person is just too lazy to do it. And even when they become informed, you know, you say, hey, here's a bunch of research that supports what I'm saying here. you know, there's a lot of people just aren't interested in lifting weight because it sounds so dull. And that's, again, why some of these, you know, play-like activities are appearing in gyms, because trainers are now trying to make it fun, you know.
Right.
When it's fun, it doesn't do you much good either, so.
You know, if changing the oil in my truck was fun, I'd probably do it a lot more often. I mean, it's something you got to do it. You got to do it. You know, there's some days I wake up, like tomorrow, I know I'm going to kick my ass. And am I looking forward to it? Yes, I might be weird, but I'm looking forward to getting a workout in. But sometimes I'm not looking forward to that just downright ass-kicking that I'm going to give myself, or I'm going to have another trainer give me. Because I know that it's hard, and, you know, there are times in the back of my mind your body's like, yeah, you're good. You're done. But, man, it takes something special to dig for, like, one or two more reps, or until, like, the weight just can't be moved anymore. And you're really trying to move it, not just like a sandbag movement, you know. You're seriously trying to push some weight. That's
I remember Arthur saying one time, and he said, you bring me a motivated athlete, one guy that may have an injury, and he's got you know, $1 million contract on the line, and in a month he's got to get himself in shape to pass the physical, or just some guy that's really motivated to work hard. And he said, I could show him how to do things and push him through a couple of workouts and give him all the instructions he needs. And then if you left him by himself in the gym, here, you got my gym, you come in 3 times a week and do this, whatever, and the guy just pumped up to crazy to do this stuff, Arthur said he might fail on his own maybe once or twice out of 12 exercises, which was the Nautilus system at the time. He said it's just too damn hard to do. So, and I can see
it
that.
Is.
We're all human beings. Yeah, it's tough.
It is tough.
That's the role of the trainers, right? Basically, is not to sit there and babysit and make up a nice little routine for this person. It's basically to push somebody toward the end of his set. So I think that's our major role. Yeah.
Yep, and keep them safe while doing it, and doing it the right way. I think we hit on everything that we should have. I mean, there's in a broad spectrum, there might be a lot to it scientifically, but when it comes down to it, there's only one way to do it, and I think we drove that home.
Yeah, there's one best way to do it, I think.
I get a lot of
trainers saying, well, there's a lot of ways to skin the cat. Yeah, but there's maybe only one best way. And certainly, if you can spend an hour total per week versus 3 hours total per week, that makes a big difference. It's a better way.
Oh, 100%. Honestly, I mean, if you tell me, hey, you're going to spend 6 hours a week in the gym, or you're going to spend a total of 90 minutes in the gym a week, but it's going to suck. I want to get on with it. I want to get on with everything else. And I've said this 1,000 times, and I'm probably going to catch heat for it because I say it all of the time, but what happens in the gym should just help you on the outside of the gym. I mean, that's, you know, your life shouldn't be inside the gym, in my opinion, even though I'm there 12 hours a day the way it is.
Yeah.
But I don't have to tell you that.
Well, I remember Jones talking about bodybuilders. He worked with bodybuilders in the early 70s until I think he got bored with the whole group. But he said that if the average bodybuilder cut his workout in half, I think this is bullet number one or two. Because he used to ask these guys, hey, what do you do? The guy would write down this large sheet of paper, either three sets of this, whatever. Arthur said, if you cut this in half, just cut the paper in half and did half of what you're doing, he said your results are probably triple, you know. So same idea.
Yeah. It's less actual, the amount of work is cut in half, but the intensity is amped way up. Yep.
Yeah. And if the intensity is high, then the duration has to be lower. That's any physical activity has that component.
It has to be. There's no other way. There's no other way. You're not.
Yeah, what I say in my book, they're mutually exclusive. If you have one, you cannot have the other. So. And my choice is intensity. Yeah.
Yep. I agree. High five. So hey, Gary, I appreciate the time, and I know everybody else out there does too. And we're gonna have to do this again. We'll maybe pick a couple of topics out of a book or something, and just hammer away at it. There's there's so much more I want to talk about, but I know people...
Well, it'd be a pleasure. It'd be a pleasure to talk again, Eric, on any topic you'd like to. You know, we don't have all the answers, but we have some, and... if it'll help people with results, that's the key. So.
And, the best thing is that we have the right answers.
Well, we think we do. Yeah, we hope we do. we certainly have some research and stories to back it up.
Exactly. All right, Gary, hey, have a great rest of your day, and I'll talk to you very soon.
Appreciate it. Okay, thanks very much, Eric. Take care.
All right, bye.
If you have any questions or comments, please find me on Twitter at FitnessCanderPodcast and at Eric Feigl, as well as Facebook, searching FitnessCanderPodcast. I'd love to hear what you have to say about featured guests and any topic suggestions you might have. Thanks again for listening.